Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established, mid-career, debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy. This episode of Conversations with Friends is with Susan White and Lauren Draper. Susan is a doctor and a writer. As a clinical geneticist, Sue hunts for answers to undiagnosed genetic conditions in children, a kind of DNA sleuth minus the trench coat. Her first novel, Take the Shot, was published by Affirm Press in 2019 and was shortlisted for the Readings YA Book of the Year for 2020 and longlisted for the Children's Book Council of Australia YA Book of the Year for 2020. Sue's unpublished adult novel, Cut, was shortlisted for the Killia Darlings Unpublished Manuscript Award in 2017. Prior to that, Sue has published in The Big Issue, Melbourne's Child magazine and The Schools magazine.
Lauren Draper is a writer based in Melbourne. Her contemporary young adult novel, The Museum of Broken Things, was shortlisted in the 2020 Text Prize and will be published by Text in 2022. Her work has also appeared in Dumbo Feather and Kill Your Darlings, and her adult manuscript was longlisted in the 2019 Richelle Prize. Lauren has worked in the publishing industry for the past 5 years and is currently the marketing manager at Hardy Grant Egmont. This was such an interesting conversation.
It was, wasn't it? These guys know each other well. I think you get the best conversations when people really do know each other very well.
They do. And also that tension, that strange tension at the core of this relationship, which is Sue, the reluctant author, you know, not reluctant author, but certainly reluctant to put herself out there, and Lauren, the marketing manager. Yeah. And the way they talk about it, it's great.
It's a lovely contradiction, I think, epitomised by the fact that Lauren was actually the person behind Sue's social media in the early days of book release.
I think that is so great. And I wanted to talk about that because I think we've maybe mentioned this on the podcast before, but in one of my little gangs of writer friends that we sometimes write emails for each other, difficult emails, because, like, especially when you're asking for more money than you would be, or when you're saying, actually, I'm not cool with that thing that happened or with this plan. In book-related things, we tend to do it for, not for anything else.
Personal.
But that it's just so much easier when you do that for someone else. You can talk someone else up better. You can be more direct. You can ask what you expect to get paid. So I love that concept. I think more people should do it.
I would be happy if someone would do Twitter for me, but I guess that's the thing about Twitter, is that you build relationships with each other, so you do miss out on the relationship. But I definitely see the appeal.
Well, also that idea that they talked about, which is that you've got to be yourself on whatever it is you choose to engage with. Otherwise, it's just, you know, pushing shit uphill, really. You don't want to be there. You know, you're saying crap because your marketing publicist has told you have to. It just does not work for anybody, I don't think.
These guys contradict, like, every single step of the way, don't they? So you have Sue talks about the book that she wrote essentially took 10 years to write. And then Lauren, and this is the story we all wish was us and hate hearing, 6 months. And produced a YA manuscript that was then shortlisted for the Text Prize.
I know, right?
Wow.
But it's also how those things that, you know, sit there simmering away, isn't it? That you take so much time. We'd talked just before that my eldest, who is struggling a little with remote learning, she's been interviewing me and doing podcast recordings. And she, like, the first question she asked was, how long did it take you to write this book? And when did you start and when did you finish? And I was like, it's a complicated answer because.
Yeah, that's true. It does stew for a while, doesn't it?
It does stew for a while. Do you know what I am so glad that Lauren defines in this? The difference between publicity and marketing. Have you ever
That is that she gives the best definition that I've heard. The definition that I had heard prior to that is that you pay for, which one do you pay for? You pay for marketing. You get publicity for free.
I remember. See, but that one but is, that confusing is confusing too. Lauren says publicity is media facing, marketing is consumer facing. And I was like, right, I'm gonna just write that down on a post-it note and stick it on my wall. Because it also helps when you have to know who to send the email to within your own publishing house. I thought that was really useful. I also think they give cracker advice to their younger writing selves.
They do.
Maybe that's an exercise everyone should have a go at.
Well, I think because it's so personalised, I always like, and Charlotte Wood says it as well, and Sue says it here, spoiler, that thing about practising confidence, that it's not a fixed or an inherent thing. And it reminded me at work we had these, like an online, trying to get people together, these virtual women's circles. And so they just basically matched you with five women from across the business. So it might be with call center and HR and all this sort of stuff. And it was really just a talk fest. But one of the things they did was to get us all to watch this little clip on confidence. And the point, I'll see if I can link into show notes. But the point that it was making was that self-esteem is built from the inside out. Confidence is built from the outside in. So it's something that if you fake it, you do actually begin to feel it.
Hello and welcome to our episode of Conversation with Friends. We are Lauren and Sue, two odd couple friends who met through their writing group. Lauren is a millennial marketing manager for Heidi Grant Egmont, and Sue, that's me, is a Gen X genetics doctor for kids who hates marketing but loves all things writing.
Our writing group has been running for 4 years and was started by our mutual friends. And although Sue and I had been at RMIT together, we somehow never crossed paths until we met in the Pump House Hotel, which quickly established a lifelong bond of words, silliness, and potato fries.
Sue, that's me, was the first of the group to be published with my YA book, Take the Shot, published by a firm in 2019, and more recently shortlisted for the Readings YA Prize and longlisted for the CBCA Book of the Year.
And me, Lauren, hello. I wrote a young adult contemporary novel called The Museum of Broken Things. It was shortlisted in the Text Prize in 2020 and will be published in 2022.
And that is something to look forward to for sure.
After this garbage year.
All right. So I wonder, Lauren, should we start with the strange incompatibility you and I have, that I've got a bit of an issue about marketing and marketing happens to be your job?
It is my whole life.
Remarkably, we are still friends, and I'm very glad for that.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a bit about how you got into marketing and how you find being a writer and working in the marketing side of publishing?
So I actually started out, I did the professional writing and editing course at RMIT, which I think half of the writing community in Melbourne has done. And I started straight out of high school. I thought I wanted to be a journalist. So I think that's why we never met. I did a lot of media, journalism, computer classes. And then I also, so I did that for about a year and then I changed track to do editing at RMIT. And I had suddenly realized that book publishing existed and I'd always been a voracious reader, but somehow it just never quite clicked that like, somebody publishes books and that's somewhere that you can work. So I wanted to be an editor really, really badly. I got a job at Black Ink as a publishing assistant, and I was sitting there one day taking in changes for this 500-page historical novel. It's a very common task for junior editors. And I very suddenly had this realization that I had the attention span of a four-year-old who's been given red cordial and that I can't actually spell. So
are they like obligatory tasks or talents for an editor, Lauren?
Yes, unfortunately, that forms the basis of being an editor. So I was sort of sitting there at this job that I loved, and I loved working with books, and I was sort of like, okay, well, the whole spelling thing is a bit of a non-starter. What else can I do? And I fell into marketing just because there happened to be a job available, and it was all of the things that I really liked. I got to write a little bit more. I got to do digital newsletters. I got to work with authors directly and festivals. And all of these sort of personal interests that I had sort of come together in marketing. And it turns out that that actually suited me a lot better, because I find, as somebody who writes after hours, it was really difficult for me to do sort of editorial work, which I think of it as using the same side of your brain as writing. And I would fatigue myself at work and come home and just be like, well, I can't do more of the same. Whereas marketing is using like a different creative side, and you're working with art and you're on the phone and you're talking to media, and I come home and I feel really energized and excited to write. So these two interests really complement each other for me.
Not so much
for you, because I understand you are very resistant to marketing, but luckily you are highly accomplished, and you are actually a geneticist at a hospital, and so your day job is wildly different to your writing, and you ended up at RMIT under very different circumstances.
You're absolutely right, and I agree with you. I'm sure our paths didn't cross, because I would have seen those subjects that drew you or attracted you, and I would have been running, sprinting in opposite direction. So that's right. My path to RMIT was via a medical degree, and then I guess about 10 or 15 years working as a pediatrician and then a geneticist. So I'm a doctor who sees children with suspected genetic conditions, and that's my day job, which I love, and I get a lot out of that job, but I also find that I put a lot in, or it takes a lot of energy. I find it a job that I come home from without much left for myself. And I did some short course writing courses in the UK when I was living there, and realized that when I'd got into medicine as an 18-year-old, I'd kind of imagined that, okay, this is it. I stop writing and I stop making music and doing some of the things I really love to do. I have to be a serious doctor now. And serious doctors don't have these kind of side, you know, sidekick habits that like writing kind of quirky fiction for teenagers. So I guess I spent that decade or more being that obedient good doctor and got a lot out of that, but this other part of me was kind of suffering or not being nourished at all. And when I got into the RMIT course, I just realized that writing and writing fiction in particular brought me this joy, and doing something creative was incredibly nourishing for me. So even though my career I kind of think is split, it's probably 80-20, mostly medicine, I have a similar sort of dichotomy or experience to you, that my day job and my writing, they kind of slightly feed each other, but they're very separate, and separate parts of my brain feel like their needs are met by those activities.
It's funny because I know you have a guitar sitting next to you right now, so you've clearly found a way to make these two parts of your life meet.
Yes, but we can reassure the listeners straight away that we're not going to subject you to any of our ISO guitar practicing, because that might instantly end the podcast.
I wanted to talk to you about your debut novel, Take the Shot, because in probably quite a natural way, your novel is about a young boy who finds out that he has a genetic condition called Marfan's. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of this project and sort of how Bug's story came to be?
Yeah, it is an interesting thing to reflect back on, particularly because Bug as a character actually first appeared in a novel I was writing in when I was studying writing for YA at RMIT, and he was actually a minor character in that novel. Sadly, that was one of those novels that was probably a process that you learn a lot from, but the end result was not the greatest piece of writing I've ever put together. But when I looked back on that novel, I could see that most of it didn't work, but there was this very energetic voice coming from this character, Bug, and he kind of stuck with me over a period of time, and I thought some more about him and I started writing a bit from his voice. I definitely didn't have a really clear idea what I was going to do with him, but he was funny and I really liked him, and I wanted to write more in his voice, and other people who read his voice were struck by it and gave me constructive feedback. So it dawned on me one day when I was writing in his voice that he was this very tall, skinny, basketball-obsessed teenager, and I thought, I think he's got Marfan syndrome. And instantly I could see the fiction potential of that, because Marfan syndrome is a genetic condition that can affect the size of the aorta. So the blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart can get bigger than it ought to, and it can be very dangerous to play competitive sport. So I could immediately see this spark of an idea. I'd started with an energetic character, but from that grew this compelling storyline of what would it be like for a teenage boy who's obsessed with basketball, and basketball is his way into all the good things in his life, to have that threatened to be taken away from him. And that's really how the idea came together. I guess, of course, working with people with genetic conditions, I get to see some of the difficult things they go through in trying to come to terms with a genetic condition. It's not typically, you know, most people with a genetic condition, they don't want to have this condition, especially young people. And that process they have to go through of finding a way to live with something they don't really want as part of their life was something I really wanted to explore.
Mm-hmm. I do find your publishing journey, in particular for Bug's book, very interesting, because a lot of emerging writers, I think there's a bit of a perception that successful writers seem to happen quite quickly. There's a lot of pressure to sort of find an agent and get your work out. But you actually took 10 or so years to write Bug's book. And I think reading it, the energy that Bug has as a reader, it makes it very clear to me that he was somebody whose story needed to be told. But how did you, as the writer of that story, maintain that energy for 10 years? Coming back to this manuscript. Yeah. And I say that as somebody who has my own 10-year-long manuscript that I occasionally want to put in the bin.
We will get to that 10-year manuscript of yours, because I think that's an important story to tell too. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I am a very persistent and probably quite stubborn person, and I knew that I had something with this kernel of an idea and the voice that I trusted. So I definitely had lots of struggles and challenges with working out how to write the plot for this story. And as you know, even after I signed the contract with a firm, I completely rewrote Take the Shot twice, still wrangling with getting the plot to take a plot that would do justice to my idea and Bug's story. And I think that was a lot of that was really about me learning enough about plot to deliver on that promise of what this story was. So I guess how did I keep it fresh? I don't know. I don't know why his voice is so strong and clear to me. Maybe some part of my subconscious exists at the mental level of a 14-year-old boy. I do now, as you know, have a now 15-year-old son who I guess perhaps gave me a few plot ideas towards the end of that decade. But, you know, he was a toddler when I was writing various drafts of it, so I don't think I can put it down to that.
You do write incredibly well from the perspective of a 14-year-old teenage boy, and it's quite funny. And for a long time I thought, oh, she's taking what Eddie says at the kitchen table and, like, that must be his character. And I found it so surprising when you said, actually, I've been writing this before I even had a son, and you don't take the majority of his dialogue. It seems to come to you quite naturally.
Yeah. I did get some help from my kids with some of the social media references in my book, like, you know, my daughter's horrified face when she saw all the punctuation I had in my text messages in the story. But, yeah, I think I can't explain it. It's a bit mysterious and possibly a bit creepy that, you know, a woman who's over 50 can talk like a 14-year-old boy, but what can I say?
You also work with kids, and you were working with young children that whole time. And I think that when you sort of occupy a child and teenage space, you do sort of absorb their what's important to them and their language and their characteristics. So it seems like you're all aspects of your life sort of seeped into this book to create the perfect story.
Yeah,
I'm going to call it perfect. I'm allowed to call it perfect because I'm your friend. And I gave it 5 stars on everything I could find.
And I love you for that. Yes, you could see me sort of, or feel me sort of recoiling at the perfect word because, of course, like any writer, I can see tiny things I might choose to change. But, yeah, you know, that idea that some people, when they're around people who have different accents, will absorb and start talking in that accent. I sort of think of it a little bit like that. So when I lived in the UK, even when I'd only lived there for a few months, my family would give me a very hard time when I would phone back to Melbourne and have this rather annoying British, sort of quasi-British accent. And I wonder if it's a bit like that people who have that ear for accents maybe also have an ear for the dialogue and subconsciously absorb the way that young people might interact. I'm glad for it anyway. It's one of those things that works for me reasonably effortlessly, and there are lots of aspects of writing I can't say that for.
And you found out you were getting published with a firm, which was fantastic, and then you rewrote your book, and then the book came out and suddenly you had to, well, somebody else at a firm was marketing your book, but you were marketing yourself as an author, which you detested. Is that the word?
In medical terms, I would say I kind of had an anaphylactic reaction to the whole sort of realization that it wasn't just my book that was going to be important to put out there into the world, and I was having enough anxiety about my book being sort of visible and being able to be read, and but that I would be out there too was something I was a bit slow on the uptake to realize. And I guess this brings us to my pathological feelings about marketing and publicity, and I should hasten to add that is no reflection on any of the wonderful team at a firm who did a great job fulfilling those roles. This is all about me, and I thought it might be useful to talk about marketing, particularly for people like me who might characterize themselves as, say, introverted or a bit shy or not ready to put themselves out there. Should we tell people, Lauren, the dirty little secret that we have or that we share about my social media accounts? And
I think it's safe to tell the world now that when you first got published and didn't know what an Instagram was, that there was a brief period of time in which I was able to moonlight as Sue White, wonderful author.
Yes, I feel this is a sort of confession time, that those first few months after the book was launched, Lauren ran my social media and it was, I learned a lot from that actually, from watching the way that you posted about my book. And of course you posted in a much more confident way than I was probably capable of. So that was a great sort of example to me of trying to put myself out there. And I also learned very practical things like where the on button was on my iPhone, what a Twitter handle was, and all these other these high-tech things, Lauren, that had just escaped me up until that time.
I did find it really funny. You told me one night that your daughter had cottoned on and said, "Mum, this isn't you. Like, this isn't how you speak." And I thought I had nailed your voice. I'd had a long time to sort of acquire the Sue White flavour of social interaction. And apparently it was not quite perfect. But you did end up with more Twitter followers than me, which is actually very funny.
Well, that's an accident. And I think, can't you claim at least half of them, given that you were me? Anyway,
it's funny. Every time occasionally my computer will get confused and still log in as you, and I like stream full of medical advice, and I'm like, I don't even know what this means. What have I subscribed to? And I'm like, look, not Sue White author anymore.
It's always fascinating when someone sends you a DM. That's the right language, isn't it? Asking for a medical advice about a rash. That's always a really interesting experience. However, let's get back onto, let's leave all dermatological afflictions aside and get back to the introverted writer. And I'm interested, Lauren, what advice you would have for someone like me who might be unpublished or in early stages of their publishing career, and the thought of putting themselves out there is just petrifying.
So it's probably not surprising at all that a lot of writers do self-identify as very introverted people. And I think that that's part of what draws us to writing, is that we get to lock ourselves alone in a room and sort of get out our inner thoughts. And that's certainly not all writers, but so one really common thing is we sign an author at work. I now work at Hardy Grant Egmont, which is a children's and YA publishing house. And we'll sign authors and then they get really excited. Their book's coming out in a year or two and they say like, okay, what do I do? Do I make a newsletter? Do I need to start a Twitter? Like, what is Instagram? How do I TikTok? And, you know, you sort of guide this conversation about what is the difference between marketing and publicity, which some emerging authors might not be aware. Publicity is media facing. Marketing is largely consumer facing. And so I always have that conversation with them, like, well, do you actually enjoy occupying social media spaces? Because I think you don't reap anything of value if you're forcing yourself to post in a way that's really not genuine. And I think that your followers and your peers know when you're sort of forcing that interaction. And so we do laugh a little bit about me setting up your social media. But once, you know, we had that conversation of what would you normally post, like, do you want to post your kids? Do you want to post your dog? Thank God the answer was yes. And so we always have that conversation of you can do as much or as little as you want. I think that if you look at very successful established authors, they often do have a really loyal audience. And I certainly do think that there is benefits to creating an engaged presence. And I think that if you look at the way that Emily Gale and Nova Wheatman recently use their social media presence, it's not just in a way that's promoting a product, it can also do incredible good, which is what we saw with Authors for Fieries. So I think people think marketing can be a little bit soulless, and I always tell people I wouldn't do my job for a bank, but I love my job working with authors, and getting them on social media is actually one very small part of a very big picture, because if you are introverted and you sort of recoil at the thought of putting yourself on the internet, you have somebody like me in-house pitching you for review copies or blog tours or festival appearances and review placements, and there's so much more to what we can do to make consumers aware of your book. So if it's something that you really recoil from, my advice to emerging authors is you don't have to do it. It is a nice thing to have, but you should not feel like you need to sell your soul to sell your book.
That's such great advice, and it really ties in for me about the need for authenticity when you're with anything in relation to your book. You're really talking about the need for the author to do things that ring true to them. Yeah. And so if you can find some aspect of social media that sits comfortably with you, then it could become a point of strength for you over time. Yeah. But that if you can't, it's not a deal breaker.
No, and I think that's a very good point, because in its best form, marketing should be helping readers find the books that they genuinely enjoy, and sometimes books that they may genuinely need. And if you, especially as a teenager now, there's sort of an overwhelming market, we really just want books to reach the people who we created them for. And I think that that's quite a lovely thing, and that's why I really enjoy my job, especially as a bookworm. I would have loved as a teenager, sort of pre-internet, to be able to be handed the book that I may have needed to read at a formative period of my life.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a bit of that around Take the Shot, I guess, with both a desire for my book to get out there to raise awareness of what it might be like for a teenager with a rare genetic condition. I must admit as well, I was quite nervous about how young people with Marfan syndrome might receive my book. Mm-hmm. But I've had some wonderful feedback that it has been a valuable thing for them to read. And it's clearly just one person's story. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't generalize to the whole community of young people with Marfan, but
and you worked with sensitivity readers as well, which is another thing that is increasingly common for authors sort of writing outside of the group that they're writing for. What was that process like?
Yeah, it was really valuable for me, and it more than anything probably settled my anxiety that one of the key anxieties I had was that Bug is quite self-deprecating, and as you know, that's a trait I carry in spades, and I guess that sort of seeped through into him. But like many teenagers, he's not that happy about his own body and lots of aspects of his life, to be honest. But he feels very self-conscious about being different and being tall and skinny, and some of the ways in which Marfan makes his body different from other people. He really is quite annoyed about that, and he would like to fit in more. And because it's written from first person, he talks about how he feels about his own body, and I was anxious how that would come across to a young person with Marfan. I guess I feel quite protective as well of young people with Marfan, that I didn't want to be in any way adding to or piling on to the distress and the difficult time they already experience. But in fact, the feedback I had from readers with Marfan syndrome was that they could really strongly identify with him, and they'd had obviously different life experiences, mm-hmm. of course, but they felt the emotional journey that he has really resonated with them. And they also gave me some great feedback on different aspects. And they found it funny as well, which was kind of just like this, I had this kind of huge exhalation of relief when I got their feedback, because they were able to appreciate the different sides of the story, the different facets of it.
Yeah, it's a very layered and complex story for a 14-year-old boy, because you say he's very self-deprecating, but he's also very awkward in sort of all aspects of his life. It's school, it's family, his hobbies. And I think that that's very, it's a very normal teenage experience to sort of feel othered at some stage for any particular reason. And I think a lot of teenagers go through that period where they don't feel like they fit anywhere, which sort of feeds back into the question that I wanted to ask you is, why did you start writing young adult at all?
It's a great question. I am just drawn to those stories with teenage protagonists. Mm-hmm. And I think the stories that I want to write are emotionally charged, authentic voices. And for whatever reason, those voices that tend to come to me in my writing tend to be teenage. I definitely had that feeling as a teenager, that other, being the other or being the outsider feeling. And for me, it was that I was kind of, I was academic, I was pretty sensitive, and I didn't feel like those were things that were very kind of acceptable in social circles. And I definitely had my friends, but I definitely had a feeling of difference that I'm sure I know informs my writing. I am interested in the other, in kind of lots of different stories. I guess that's a pretty common writing theme, isn't it? And it comes into my adult novel as well, being the other. So the adult novel that I'm referring to is about a female surgeon who's trying to make it in a very male-dominated workplace. And when I think about why I'm trying to write that story, it does come back to this very strong attraction I have to stories that tell that other perspective and illuminate what it might be like.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So we've talked a lot about Take the Shot, but I'm interested to hear from you because you have two YA novels, one which is signed to text, The Museum of Broken Things, which I have to say I have a bit of envy, writing envy about in the nicest possible way, because Lauren Draper, did you write that book in 6 months?
I did, which is very funny because I have a feeling you're about to ask me about my other manuscript. So I love everything text does. I had always admired the text prize. I had always admired Heidi Grant's Ampersand Prize, and I work there now, so I can't submit to that. But I sort of had this idea ticking around in my brain, and there were certain elements that every so often felt like they would click, like it should be set here and this should be the point of conflict and this is where this girl should be coming from and this is what her emotional journey should be. And then I suddenly felt like it had percolated long enough and I needed to start writing it. So it had, although I wrote it in 6 months, I had been thinking about it for a while. And
I started writing. That's your excuse, that you've been thinking about it for a while. I'm talking about books that have taken me 10 years, Lauren, 10 years.
Well, I very much like you. I'm very stubborn. And so I was like, oh, I'll submit to the text prize. It's in 6 months. That doesn't matter. Got a foster puppy along the way. That killed my creativity for a good month. So I felt like I was coming to workshopping and just blurting like 20 and 30 pages at you being like, I'm so sorry. Like I'm on a, I've given myself this like crazy deadline. And I was shocked when it was shortlisted because, to be completely honest, you can't, like, I'm sure there's people out there who can, but as aforementioned, I'm not a very good speller. And I felt like it definitely could have used another round of editing before I submitted, but I was thrilled that it even got shortlisted, and doubly so to know it's being published.
So we should talk a bit about what it's about. And the first thing I have to say about this book is I completely love the voice of your main character, Reese. I think if I had to describe her, I think she is smart and funny and honest and authentic. And if I imagine if I put my mind in the people assessing the text prize, that's what they responded to. They weren't so concerned about your, you know, spelling of 5-syllable words, right?
Yes. And I think as a reader and as a writer, I'm definitely drawn more to character-driven stories. And as somebody who has had to read my early drafts, you may know that there are occasionally a few major plot holes because I think Well, does the plot really matter? Can't I just write about people and how they interact with each other? But no, apparently there needs to be a driving force, and that's important.
But Reese does have a driving force, doesn't she? She's seeking answers about some things that have happened in her life.
Yes, and I don't want to give too much away, because that is the crux of the novel, is that she's moved to a small beachside town and she's recently lost her grandmother, and she's really struggling to come to grips with this enormous loss in her life, and she feels very adrift and very lonely. And you know at the start of the novel that she's moved away from her friends, but you don't know why. And so she goes on this journey that's really about finding friendships and really healing and finding herself as a person who's coming towards the end of teenagerdom and is sort of teetering on that edge. And I wanted to look at that really awkward, terrifying period in your life when you're sort of at the end of school and you suddenly realize that you're meant to know what comes next. And myself and many others just don't know what that is.
Yeah, it really comes through, I think, that sort of she's at some kind of fork in the road, I think, in terms of where the direction her life's going to take. And it's a very satisfying read. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing that being a thing. I'm interested to talk a bit about the longer term project that you have to your work in progress.
Yes. My 10-year novel.
Your 10-year novel. And I'm curious whether you think you learned things about the 10-year novel that helped you spit out the Museum of Broken Things in 6 months, or whether you see the two things as, because their stories are very different, right?
They're completely different, and I could not tell you why I decided. So the novel that I've been writing for 10 years, as Sue and I keep referring to it, is a young adult fantasy novel, and I think I started writing it because I was 19 years old. I was at RMIT, and fantasy is what I was reading as an actual young adult, and I was really drawn to these stories. But so often the heroes sort of were these very particular types of people, and this was sort of like slightly pre-Katniss Everdeen. I was like, well, this sucks. Like, why don't we have like lady heroes and all of these stories? So I started writing this, and whether or not the world still needs that story, I don't know. But it was just so difficult to write this novel when every so often you have to pause and be like, what are mud huts made out of in the 16th century? Like, what kind of underwear did they wear underneath their dresses? And it was this really fatiguing process. And you're completely right that I'm very glad that I wrote it, and it certainly evolved in complexity over those years. And in fact, it's a completely different book. Like, I've probably written it 3 or 4 times at this stage, but I think it needed to be written for me. And that's another thing that I like to tell emerging writers, is that it's okay to write a book that's just for you. It's not worth less because it's not published. And I think all of the faults that I had in this novel, I was very wary of when I started writing Reese's story. And so when I tell people it's been ticking over in my head, what I actually had in my head was, don't you dare start writing this story before you know how it's going to end, because that's what caught you the first time. The processes could not have been more different at all. They were different genres. They were written under incredibly different circumstances. They were written for different reasons. And I think I knew a lot more about myself as a person, as a writer, when I wrote this contemporary novel. And it's also a lot easier to write when you know what kind of underwear people wear. Yeah.
If I can offer one other observation, and I don't know if this is true for you, but I think it might be, that maybe the validation of getting the shortlisting for the Museum of Broken Things might have sort of propelled you onwards with your fantasy novel and your redrafting of that. Do you think that might be true?
Yeah, it's very true. So this contemporary novel got shortlisted and was eventually picked up to be published. And I had been tinkering with this fantasy book, and I actually, although I say it took me 10 years to write, there was periods of years at a time where I didn't touch it. At the start of this year, I sort of reread it, and I was like, you know what? This isn't as terrible as I remember it. Like, there are very obviously things wrong with it. There's definitely a different story that needs to be told than I initially thought. And I started going through it at this pace that had previously not been accessible to me for some reason. It was like this mental block had been removed, but I also knew now how I worked when I had more of a plot in mind and more of a goal. Whereas I wrote this and I was like a bit like tra-la-la, like words are nice, and I had no plans. And it drove one of our mutual friends insane. She's like, what happens next? And I'm like, I don't know. Yes, the novel is very different and better for having been on the back burner for so long. But I definitely feel that that first draft, although terrible, still needed to be written.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing the next steps with that story. I wondered whether we should talk a bit about the differences between us, which we've touched on with our attitudes to marketing, but whether we should touch on some of the other differences, like the 20-year age gap between us. Mm-hmm. And I know that at times when we've workshopped together, that's been highlighted by different language that I've used or that you've used, where it's almost like we need a translator to understand each other because we're from different generations.
You introduced this delightful phrase. It's my favourite. I slip it into conversation now whenever I possibly can, and it's in my contemporary draft because I thought it was so funny. You wrote hammers and tongs at one point. Yeah, and I
just one
it.
Hammer, one hammer, Lauren. If you're going to use it, please use it correctly.
That also makes sense.
Yeah, one hammer.
Hammer
and tongs. And I might have used this phrase initially to describe an in-hospital sex scene in my surgeon novel. And I remember you just looking completely like nonplussed and like, is your surgeon becoming a blacksmith? What's going on here? And I was like, you know what I mean? Hammer and tongs, you know, all in, like, you know, they're going for it. And, yeah, I'd lost you. I'd lost you with the hammer for sure.
It also gave me the giggles. And it was this scene that was actually very, it was quite tense and dark, and there's a lot going on in the background. And I, as soon as you told me what it meant, I was giggling the whole time. Like, this is not the tone of this book. But I had the giggles.
I'm sad to say I did take it out, but I'm attached to it, and I'm going to put it in somewhere, and I'm going to dedicate it to you. And on my side, I think I've experienced the joy of working out with you how we're going to kill off various characters, because can I just say some of your plot lines to knock people off have been a bit iffy.
I do enjoy a good killed off character, but apparently some of the plots were a bit far-fetched. And again, maybe that's my lack of poor planning, but apparently you can't just give someone pustules and boils for no good reason.
No, that's right. And you know, it's hard to die from a skin condition. It's possible, but it's a challenge. But I like those challenges you set me. And I do enjoy killing off a good character or two.
I also say my Google search history at one time was quite concerning, because it was things like, how much blood can you lose before you die? How to quietly kill somebody off? And I was so sure that at any moment someone would be busting down my door just to sort of check in. But I have you to guide me.
I'm very happy to fulfill that role.
I do find it also, it's very interesting. We're both writing young adult, and you do occasionally also try to slip in words like luster with your teenage boy characters.
Listen, I still believe somewhere in the world there will be a teenage boy who might use the word luster. My entire workshopping group canned that idea, I should say.
I was on board. I gave my character a word of the day. I gave my character a word of the day calendar so that I could include the phrase snollygoster.
What? A what?
So by all means, please use luster. I'll allow it.
Thank you. Yes, he probably does need some sort of sophisticated reading habit or something to justify the language I want to give him. We've talked a few times about and with no disrespect to teenage boys, but the challenge of writing realistic teenage boy dialogue when in the real world there may only be sort of monosyllabic grunts and possibly no words at all, just sullen looks. And meantime, we would quite like them to articulate some beautifully crafted sentence with the word luster in the middle.
I'm going to keep an eye out for Eddie next time I see him after lockdown, which will probably be 2 years from now, and maybe he will be using luster.
Yes, so Eddie, my son, does provide me with some very good dialogue at the breakfast table. He is a chatty person in the morning, and I write early in the morning, so he is often the first person up after me, and he will often deliver a bit of a monologue over his muesli, which I have been known to transcribe word for word.
I do find this is another point of difference. When you say early in the morning, you actually mean 5 a.m., which for me, I've been asleep for about 3 hours at this stage, and I cannot understand how you can possibly write coherent sentences at 5 a.m.
I know it is a strange thing, but it works for me, and I often will not write for very long. I might write for an hour at the most, but I find it's really effective at keeping at bay the to-do list in my mind that particularly relates to work and the hospital and my patients and my family. As soon as I click into the mode of thinking about all the things I need to do for those things, I find it really hard to move back to a more mellow, contemplative, creative place. So I sort of have to do it at the start of the day. Otherwise, I feel like that thread, that link to my imaginative self is cut, and I can't trace it again. But yes, it does involve being up very early, and it's just me and the dog and my cup of tea. But actually, as an introvert, I'm quite happy in that little cocoon of darkness. It's not bad.
I conversely write. I do my best work between 9 p.m. and about midnight. And I think that there is definitely something in having that sort of dark, quiet space. And I can write during the day, but it takes about 3 more cups of coffee to get me going than it would otherwise.
So to finish our conversation, I thought maybe we might both come up with some advice that we would give to our younger writing selves that might be helpful to other up-and-coming writers or unpublished writers.
I think that's a great question, because I think once you really admire established authors, it's very likely that you sort of get stuck in your head of how did they achieve this huge success. But actually, what I found most useful is realizing that the early drafts and the words that aren't quite right and the angst, even the angsty journals you start as a teenager, all of these crappy drafts are valuable even if you don't publish them, because they're leading somewhere. And having this manuscript that sort of languished for so many years has really taught me that. So if you need to write something just for yourself, that is equally valuable as writing something that's going to be published. So write crappy words and let them be, because you can't, I think there's that age-old advice, you can't edit something that doesn't exist. So even if you're writing something terrible, you've written something, and that's always valuable.
Yeah, I really like that.
Yeah. What would you tell young budding writer Sue?
I would definitely encourage young writer Sue to have a reframe about the parts of the work that are not working. So I used to run a mile from the bits of my novel that weren't working, because they made me panic. I didn't know what to do with them, and I wanted it to work, and I was impatient for the whole thing to function as a cohesive whole, and I didn't want to find out that chapter 6 was a dud and I needed to do something about that. What I learned definitely through the editing process was in fact that an opposite attitude could bring about really good things. So, you know, working with an editor sort of forced me to look at those bits that weren't working. And in fact, once I kind of embraced that and stewed in the bits that weren't working and even maybe celebrated finding them, it's a good thing to know where your book is not working and to stew and sit in it. I liken it to this sort of sitting with the uncertainty and trying to listen to where the story is telling you it wants to go. That's been a really powerful sort of epiphany for me to work out. And if I may sneak in a second piece of advice to a young writer, Sue, is to cultivate your own confidence, almost practicing becoming more confident as a writer, because I think lack of confidence is probably one of the most, the biggest obstacles a lot of young writers, and certainly I had to and have to continue to tackle.
Yeah, that's really wonderful advice. And I look very much forward to tweeting this conversation with friends from your Twitter account very shortly.
And I'll be very grateful for you to do so. And no one is ever going to know for any tweet that I ever send in the future, is it Sue or is it Lauren?
If it's about aortas, it's probably Sue. All right. Thank you very much. I've had a wonderful time talking about our writing with you, and I look forward to listening back to this, hopefully.
Thanks, Lauren. Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons. This series is supported by the City of Melbourne through a COVID-19 arts grant.